This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. A major nuclear accident, an explosion at a nuclear waste dump in the Soviet Union, wreaked great environmental damage in the late 50s, but the accident was kept a secret. So when my guest, scientist Joris Medvedev, published an article about it, the West viewed his claim as a fantasy. So Medvedev, a scientist exiled from the Soviet Union in 1973 for his dissident writings, wrote a book to prove the accident occurred. He searched through official Soviet literature and CIA documents to find proof of the disaster, and his book, Nuclear Disaster in the Urals, is now accepted as the definitive account. Medvedev is now a senior research scientist for the National Institute for Medical Research in London, and once again, he's used his research skills and knowledge of the Soviet Union to investigate the explosion at Chernobyl, April 26, 1986. His account is the book, The Legacy of Chernobyl. Not only are the effects on public health profound, but the accident, says Medvedev, forced the Soviet Union to embrace both perestroika and glasnost. It took 2 days for the rest of the world to find out about the explosion at Chernobyl. I asked Joris Medvedev why it took so long.
Oh, the problem is that Soviet Union usually didn't disclose details about serious industrial accidents, and the government didn't realize that in this case the enormous amount of radioactivity was released, and within one day it's actually reached Poland and Sweden and Finland. It's only because it was Sunday, nobody in the Western Europe found about this, but Russian service, which monitored radioactivity, was so poor that they didn't actually realize that the radioactivity crossed the border.
You trace the account of the bureaucratic activity in the Soviet Union right after the accident, and it seems that nobody in the Soviet Union took it seriously.
Because in Soviet Union there is very complex system, and people who were on the spot, they tried to falsify or try to minimize the scale of the disaster, and then the ministerial level also tried to minimize. So finally the government got distorted picture and was not able to react accordingly. So just the bureaucratic system where everybody wants to avoid bad news made the Soviet government to react so poorly on this disaster as well.
As I understand it, the initial story was that the reactor exploded as the result of a safety test that went awry, whereas in fact you've discovered that it was a safety system that was being put in several years after it went into operation.
Yes, that's right. The problem is that this reactor needs a special system because this, first of all, the reactor is very, very large. The shutdown system works very, very slow. Therefore, it needed special system which provide electricity in case of blackout or some other accidents. But this system was tested before reactor was completed, but didn't work properly. So finally, official decided to start commercial exploitation of reactor without the system being actually installed. And the only way to make the correction of this error was to wait until the first cycle of reactor work be ended. And this is why they started to install this test system and test, of course, the system when reactor was actually was scheduled for maintenance shutdown, which was most wrong time to try to do something with reactor at this time of the cycle.
You quote a number of conversations that went on at Chernobyl right after the explosion that reveal some of the attitudes of officials, and some of them read like a play by Havel or Kafka. A minister asks, why does the station not have the proper monitoring instruments, some radiometers to measure the amount of radiation? And the minister is told, ah, sir, the accident wasn't in the plan. The unthinkable has happened.
Oh, yes, it's very strange. The description of the governmental commission first meetings and some other stories indicate that even director of the whole power station didn't have proper dosimeters. Neither the safety department nor actually individual reactor engineers or plant managers had any dosimeter which would give you reading when serious contamination happened. All the dosimeters were very primitive type, and only the civil defense and then army did bring the proper dosimeters, because army had dosimeters which were scaled for the case of nuclear war, and this happened to be proper systems to measure activities.
Now, and a dosimeter was actually ruled to be, if you had one, it was considered a criminal offense after this accident.
Oh, yes, it's after these accidents, all research institutes in Kyiv and some other areas in Soviet Union where dosimeters did exist, they were forbidden to make measurements outside of laboratories, and even inside laboratories, they were sealed. But now the situation changed under pressure from the population in Belarus and Ukraine. Finally, the dosimeters were legalized, and the Soviet Union now even tried to make commercial pocket dosimeters for population and to give it to people in order to introduce certain elements of calm and trust, because people do not trust official measurement. They want to measure themselves.
It seems that there have been a significant shift in psychological attitudes. In part, anxiety is increased when people have less information, when they know that there is a genuine emergency at hand.
Oh, yes, this is certainly true. But it's not only psychological. The problem is that a lot of restrictions were introduced by the Ministry of Health. People were not allowed to drink milk from their cows, from locally produced milk. They were not allowed to eat some fruits, collect mushrooms in the forest, which is a century-old tradition in Russia. They were not allowed to walk in the forest. Children were not allowed to play outside. Therefore, the population, which continued to live in heavily contaminated area, realized that something is extremely hazardous around, that they felt that they live in very unhealthy or dangerous environment, and therefore all health troubles, even cold or anything which they suffer from, either old age or children troubles and so on, would be linked to Chernobyl. But what is worse, it now realized that damage to the thyroids, because iodine, radioactive iodine level was very, very high during the first few weeks. The damage to the thyroid is really very serious, and thousands of children are suffering of effect of thyroid deficiency now. And this, of course, created very serious anger of the population. And the government now has tried to realize certain measures, even sending these children to many countries for treatment, in order to show people that they're doing their best in order to improve their health.
You make the point that the need for the Soviet government to finally open up about what had happened at Chernobyl led both to perestroika and to glasnost. I wonder if you could explain that connection.
Well, first of all, glasnost was not real glasnost before Chernobyl accident. There were some very select. It was improvement with the situation before, but the government still used the censorship. Censorship was abolished only from August 1st this year. But when Chernobyl happened, glasnost was again in trouble, because people in Ukraine and in Belarus and in Soviet Union, they realized that the government is telling actually false information, again, kind of propaganda, false information, and this created very serious political problems in Ukraine and Belarus, because local officials, when election time, they lost their seats because public was very angry about all this false information they were told. So finally, at the local level, they started to ignore all the restrictions, and finally it became impossible to keep the full truth from the public. And only last April, the Supreme Soviet discussed and debated the Chernobyl problem, and the Party Congress last July debated Chernobyl problem in the way they should do this from the very beginning. So finally, you can't hide the disaster of this scale. You can't hide the health problem of of scale which affect millions of people, and therefore after 4 years they started to tell real truth, and unfortunately this didn't help people who already absorbed very significant dose of radiation and will suffer next decade.
My guest is Joris Medvedev. He's a senior research scientist for the National Institute for Medical Research in London. His new book is The Legacy of Chernobyl. What have been the effects of radiation on food supply and some of the long-term effects of radiation that we've seen over the past few years? Will there be future health problems caused from eating this food?
Well, this is a very serious problem, but Soviet Union actually didn't destroy neither meat nor milk. They tried to use processing in order to reduce contamination level, and they also did rise for the first few weeks, did rise the permissible standards in order to accommodate very, very heavy contamination.
What do you mean by processing? Like making hamburger?
Like making butter from milk, because milk was considered entirely useless because it had a very high level of either radioactive iodine or cesium. But if you make butter, and then from butter most of the liquid is removed, and therefore a lot of radioactive products also removed. Butter still will have radioactivity, but it's be lower level. So by this way, it was possible to remove some radioactivity and to use these products. Also, they decided to use, let us say, contaminated meat, not for human consumption, but for animal consumption, for other purposes, for cat food or dog's food and so on. So nothing was actually destroyed. And this is, of course, is very serious problem, because sometimes this contaminated food was used for sausages. They tried to mix contaminated meat with clean meat from other regions. They used to send carcasses of contaminated meat all over the Soviet Union, where it was in meat plants, was processed with other meats. Finally, in order to reduce the level of radioactive cesium down to the so-called permissible level. But this was very short-sighted practice, because eventually it will increase the incidence of cancer, incidence of other disease. So finally, the government or the country will lose. But this effect will be visible only in 20 and 30 and 40 years time. So I think officials decided that nobody will be able to recognize when it's all be well forgotten. But I feel that it will not be forgotten for many years yet.
How did you do your research for this, to learn about the hidden details of the Chernobyl accident? How did you learn about the details of what's actually going on in an area that's been closed off to the outside world?
No, I used my experience because I did study the previous very serious nuclear accident in Kishtym in Urals in 1957. I published a book about it in 1979. And this accident was entirely unknown in the West, and in Soviet Union also very few people knew about this. So I used analysis of literature, analysis of all kind of publication everywhere in Soviet biological, medical newspapers, local newspapers, all reports, Soviet reporting for International Agency for Atomic Energy, American report of American the Department of Energy. Many countries publish their reports, and by comparing these reports with previous publications, I was able to find, for example, about that this was not the test of the new safety system. It was installment of the system which should be already there, because I found the description of design requirements of this reactor and so on. So you need actually to read a lot of literature and to try to analyze this literature like a kind of scientific detection story. And then you might find some pieces of information which give you opportunity to recreate the real scale and real developments.
Your father was arrested when you and your twin brother, the historian Roy Medvedev, were 12. How did this incident shape your life?
Well, it did shape my life and my brother's life in a very profound way, because, first of all, loss of the father was major family disaster, and it changed our attitude toward the system, toward the Soviet life, because it's very specific life. It changed other people's attitude toward us. We became kind of isolated family. We were evicted from the apartment where we lived, so we had to travel to different places to ask support of our relatives, which gave us support, and so on. Finally, it affected us until the actually Stalin death, because in all Soviet questionnaires, all Soviet promotions, you need to fill to answer questions. Either you have relatives who been repressed by Soviet state, and you answer yes, and you give details about this. So it's affected life in a way that we were discriminated in many ways, but we were able to survive, and probably it gave us some immunity from harassment later, when it's also we had to face some problems during Brezhnev time.
What do you remember about your father's arrest the night the Stalin's KGB came to the door?
Oh, it's very good in my memory, because we've been all at home. We already were sleeping, actually. It was they used to come to houses after midnight. So I just was wakened by the very strong knock in the door. I heard my father answer, somebody else talk. Then I again fell asleep. But when I waked, there was already a search in the apartment, because they had to search apartment in order to try to find something subversive, something anti-Soviet. It's a kind of usual routine of the arrest. So they came to a room where we were sleeping. They were searching the room, trying to find something. Our father was a military man, officer, and therefore I immediately realized that this is an arrest, because fathers of some of my friends were arrested before. It was not first arrest I witnessed, not witnessed, but I knew about, because it was nearly 2 years of terror, or 2 years of arrests in Soviet Union. My father was arrested in 1938, but the peak of the arrest was in 1937. So we immediately realized that this was the arrest of our father, and then it was minutes of saying goodbye and kisses and crying and so on. It was terrible. Terrible morning, yes, for all of us, for our mother, for my brother as well.
And you never saw him again?
Oh, we never saw him again, yes. We received some letters from his place of his exile in Kolyma, in Magadan, in Far East, but there were a few letters trying to encourage us, but then we found that he was ill, and then our letters started to return back with the notice that Adrisi died. So it again was a terrible shock for my mother, for myself, for my brother. It was just a few months before the war. It was very senseless, because Stalin actually decapitated nearly 90% of high-ranking officers and generals were arrested before the war, which made war much more bloody and much more difficult for the whole country.
What had you been doing to have the Soviet regime later assign you to a mental hospital for, what was it, paranoid delusions of reforming society?
Yeah, that's right, yes. Oh, it was because I was working in science, and it was at the time of Khrushchev, there was pseudoscientific, during Stalin time as well, Lysenko affair, so-called Lysenko domination in biology and in genetics. And many geneticists, many biologists fought Lysenko, and I did write a book about Lysenko, about his pseudoscientific, how he became so influential and so on. And this book was circulating in so-called Samizdat, very widely circulated. And finally, I decided to publish it, but nobody wanted to publish it in Soviet Union, so I decided to publish it in the United States, and it was published in 1969. And after this book was published, I was immediately dismissed from my position as the head of the laboratory in Molecular Biology Institute. But I continued to write, decided to write some more works on Soviet science, on plight of Soviet science. And when they realized that I continue to write rather than to confess or to express regret about what I have done, they put me into mental hospital. And then finally I was released.
What did they do to you when you were in the mental hospital?
Oh, they didn't do anything. They tried to convince me that I am ill. They didn't started any kind of drug therapy because immediately after I was put in mental hospital, there was very many protests from very prominent scientists inside Soviet Union and outside Soviet Union. So my case was under constant supervision from world community of scientists, from foreign journalists in Moscow. So they were not not actually trying to treat me from my delusions. Finally, I was released, but release was not just acceptance that I am healthy. They just told that I'm not so badly ill to be in hospital, so I could be outpatient so, to visit them every month, which I, of course, didn't make.
So you've been an outpatient in London since, what, 1973?
Yes, 73, yes.
Is your brother still in the Soviet Union?
Oh, he's still, he's in Soviet Union. He actually became very influential figure. He was elected as a member of People's Congress and as member of Supreme Soviet as well. So he's now member of parliament, like a congressman in America. And his books were published last year and this year on Stalin and some other problems. So he became quite a prominent figure among Soviet and Russian intellectuals.
It seems that the Chernobyl accident has sparked perestroika and glasnost, sort of curious fallout, if you will, from the accident, and also has affected attitudes about nuclear energy in a country that has been dependent on energy generated by nuclear power plants. How will the Soviet Union change its need for power? Will it try to go for more oil from the Middle East, for instance?
Not really. First of all, they have a problem with currency. According to Soviet program, which was actually delivered in end of 1985, the Gorbachev report, Soviet Union was expected to have 20-25% of all electricity from nuclear energy in 1990, which is this year, and about 45% of all energy requirement from nuclear energy in the year 2000. And this program wasn't entirely irrelevant now. It's actually clear to everybody. So all the Soviet long-term programs were linked to development of nuclear energy. And when this happened not to be the case or not possible anymore, and it took 2 or 3 years for the government to realize, then perestroika did take a different turn. They started to think about energy-saving technologies. They started to think about market economy as more efficient, more oriented to consumers. So the whole blueprint for development of Soviet Union changed as a result, because they realized that there is no any room to increase the energy output in the country, at least for the next 5-10 years, and they need to find different ways to economize. And they decided to follow the same way which Western world made during energy crisis in the 70s, where the energy-saving economies started to emerge as the best way to solve the crisis.
Dr. Medvedev, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Georges Medvedev. His book is The Legacy of Chernobyl. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.